Hello and welcome to the Weird Things Podcast. I'm Justin Robert Young, joined as always by Brian Brushwood.
Hey man, ever since we always did this show with two people, we made sure that we got the two people who are the scientificiest.
Yep.
On today's agenda.
It's going to be a serious show. Going to be a serious show, Brian.
Oh, is it?
Can't
get more serious.
Don't get silly.
Why would we?
Andrew's gone for 1 week, okay? He trusted us. He left one note on the refrigerator.
Yes.
Said, you're allowed to order a few pizzas. Whatever you do, don't get too silly on the show. You have a whole nother podcast where we get silly.
Yes.
Don't get silly on this one. This is a Weird Things podcast. We talk about news of the weird. And we talk about science.
Yep. So, I don't want to cast aspersions.
Don't cast an aspersion either. Don't get too silly and don't cast an aspersion.
I'm just saying track record is Andrew leaves.
Mm-hmm.
New York Times article says, whoopsie doodle, SpaceX had a boo-boo.
Oh no.
It actually was kind of harrowing because I didn't know what exactly to be looking for as I was reading through.
What is the headline here? I have not read about this.
SpaceX rocket fails. Basically the first stage goes off just fine. And it was kind of funny watching the video feed, not knowing when the trouble was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's like, well, everything looks good there. And then basically the second stage didn't make it as high as it should in order to properly deploy the Starlink satellites.
Yeah.
Here, I guess.
We'll... And so that's what this was about. This was about launching more Starlink.
Yes. And they Elon tweeted that maybe not, they would be able to get them to the right, perigee, whatever the thing is that says they're up high enough.
Yeah.
But you can see
that
here
is after this malfunction.
Right. So it was the first stage or the top stage. The first stage came back home, landed just fine on a drone ship. Second stage had some kind of error. They had to scuttle it in space. What do they call it? An RUD?
Talk to Paul.
Wait, what?
Paul Rudd. Moving on.
Oh, never mind. They had a unscheduled disassembly. A rapid unscheduled disassembly, yes, is what they call it. But there you can see the fairing going off.
Is them launching all the satellites, but they know now that it's not as high as it needs to be.
Yeah. So my guess is they had some instrumentation that showed that, ooh, we don't have much time. And so they just got them out and they're hoping to adjust. Maybe they'll stay in orbit. Maybe they won't. But apparently it was to quote SpaceX, a quote, very rare glitch happened. So,
well, yeah, I mean, the subhead there, the New York Times article that you had up, said it was the first malfunction like this since 2015 or 2016, which is a mighty long time when you are launching rockets into the sky. It is literally rocket science. So I wonder what is happening. We're watching this now, and I guess
listen to a little bit of an audio here. You could, I don't know if they necessarily make a bunch of panic sounds or anything. Here, let me turn on this audio here. Okay, we do have audio. Not talking at this moment. But I believe the video keeps going to show the first stage landing again,
So that is on the left for anybody. Well, we don't have a video version of this. So on the left, you see a rocket that is landing and hitting the propulsion. But now on the right, you are seeing the rocket that is still in orbit that seems to be struggling.
Is trying to get to orbit anyway.
Yeah.
Phase one entry current startup.
Yeah. I wonder if you can hear them actually. What's funny is the part that's working just fine is the part that looks like utter chaos on the left.
Yeah, that's the one where the camera is pointing down as now the rocket is firing so it can land correctly onto the drone ship. Meanwhile, the one in space is rapidly disassembling.
Well, I believe that that looks to be a bunch of accumulated CO2 or something on the inside. Yeah, so I don't know. Let's see if we can at least catch the first stage. It's now 3 kilometers up. Oh, and then they just shut it off.
And then they just shut it down.
Okay.
Stage two is in terminal guidance.
Oh, stage two is in terminal guidance, they're saying. So they're like, so they basically, they have the stream going.
Stage one landing.
Like they hold the feed long enough for like, stage one landed. It was fine. Anyway, that's all for now, folks.
Stage one landing confirmed.
There we go.
And then they cut just it. Cut it. They're like, nothing to see here.
Cut it. Hard.
This one's a bad one. This one's a bad one. We should have done it.
Yeah. Yeah. Dump it. Dump it. This is a mistake.
You know why I can't be Troll Boy.
Yeah. I mean, but I'll tell you what. It demonstrates again what we have covered on this podcast for years and years and years, that this is a moment that proves the rule that you could do 300 of these things before something goes wrong. And thankfully it was not on anything that, I mean, it'll cost SpaceX a tremendous amount of money. I mean, these launches already are very expensive to like human numbers. They are cheap for rocket launches, which is the reason why they're so popular, but it'll cost them some money, but they're going to learn a lesson, and it's a lesson that's been rare for them. Because they've been able to do these things so clockwork.
Well, and luckily it was a case of, it sounds like the majority of the payload, I assume all of it, because I believe they had been packing in a bunch of Starlink satellites with almost every other launch that they had been doing. But in this case, I believe this one was primarily fire off some
Starlinks whenever they're in the neighborhood.
Well, you remember there was that one where they had a rapid unscheduled disassembly on the launch pad during a test run that had a Facebook satellite, and that was kind of like who likes practice?
Yeah,
who's ready to try again?
Whoopsie doodle.
Yeah. And then meanwhile, you know, most of the other explosions like this that we've been seeing have been, with the ambitious testing of the Starship.
That's a prototype. They are still getting that into its final form before they actually try to do something with it.
Yeah.
And by do something, I mean go to space. That gigantic ocean liner of a monstrosity, push that old cow into the stars.
That was when I think about going to space, I can't help but think about just how sincere William Shatner was when he was talking about how
set this up for folks who don't have the context.
Sure. I was lucky enough to host a Q&A with William Shatner in Lubbock, Texas, about a year ago. Yeah. In it, you know, the question of what was it like to go to space came up. And keep in mind, the Blue Origin rocket really does go past the Kármán line. It really goes to legitimate space. But of course, you know, the pictures we see of space, we see, you know, just star-filled skies. Those are very highly curated. They're, you know, with incredible magnification. So space seems awash with opportunities. And yet, when you're blinded by the reflected light of planet Earth beneath you, it's a different animal. The only thing that you can literally see outside of maybe the moon is the Earth beneath you.
Yeah.
And he describes in that wonderful Shakespearean poetry that only William Shatner can manufacture, just this burning desire to want to go home and take very, very good care of Earth. I don't know. I reflect back on that because viscerally I understand why that would be the case, but also it seems so clear that mankind's destiny is to, you know, get off of this rock.
Sure. And I think the way that I remember him putting it is that when he finally got to space, as he had so famously been in fiction, as Captain Kirk, what he saw as the reality was death. There was inky black death, and he looked back to Earth and saw it teeming with life, and he became very, very aware that this is the difference that he wants to fight for. He wants to make Earth as prosperous as possible. But I think I don't know if it necessarily goes against the idea that, you know, America
before anybody else. Hey, first in line, buddy. Line forms in my butt.
That Earth will survive by going to other planets. But at the same time, you don't need to fetishize how awesome the road is. And that's what space is. Space is just the place between, you know, life-sustaining outposts. The question is, will we create and put people in those kinds of outposts?
Yeah,
especially as we in our generation and our children's generation.
It's that sentiment of the road out west is pretty harsh. Makes me think of our friend Andrew Heaton's story of his grandparents were literal Oklahoma land rushers. And when they planted their flag, they're like, great, now what? And the answer was, hide from coyotes.
Yeah.
And so they literally dug a cave and slept in a cave. Like he is two generations removed from cave dwellers. From
cave dwellers. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the frontier life ain't for the faint of heart. We are soft handed, silly bobbies, compared to the rough and tumble folks that have come before us and will likely come after us for the price of settling the lunar frontier or the spatial frontier. We're gonna need hard people because that ain't an easy business, especially if we're looking to dig pressurized tubes into Mars or terraform or anything like that.
Where are you at on genetically modifying human pioneers? And because this is
genetically modifying the sissy out of frontiersmen.
You're about to have a child. Like if you,
what?
if time was advanced a little bit and it's just like, hey, I assume it'll start with tiny little changes where it's like, hey, we discovered this genetic marker that makes you 50% more hardened to cosmic rays, reducing your chance of getting cancer while you're on Mars. Like, do you accept that? And then the next, let's say X number of years from now, then it's like, okay, you know, your bones get really brittle and weak when you're in zero gravity. Also, why do you have legs in zero gravity? Wouldn't you rather have four sets of arms? We could just tweak that. Like it's going to be a series of interesting, decisions that seem gross on the surface now to us, but it's like, okay, you're going to want the full package for Spacer. What does it include? Well, they're born, they're going to live, they're going to die in space. You're going to want their inner ear modified so that they're never dizzy.
Okay, hold on. Lay out the world where this is necessary. Because it seems like you have a very specific world in mind where there are stratas of humans that are non-Earth or planetary. They are living in space exclusive. So before I judge your thoughts, please lay out the world that you are filling out in your head.
I'd give you, let's say, give or take the expanse, right? Minus the sci-fi
load
booth.
OS the expanse.
Yes. Yeah. Something where
are we also loading in the economic strata that kind of powers the story there? That the planetary based people have less money and they're essentially wage slaves.
We could keep that in there, but we are going to subtract the magic fast go-go engines that they have that cause you to be able to go 1G each direction. wherever you're
going. Okay, so we have slow boats.
We have slow boats, which means that, you know, there's lots of problems with being unshielded from cosmic rays. There's lots of problems from being at low G. Your body becomes brittle.
So these people are not only living in space all the time, they are traveling between these destinations often.
Yeah, and possibly, let's say, and at the far end, we don't have to go this far if you don't want to. Let's allow for intergenerational travel. Let's say we find a couple of exoplanets that seem like good ideas that take, quote unquote, only 3 to 5 generations of humans to live in a space arc. Although even then you'd have a little bit of gravity. But my point being, if you could modify...
All right.
Would you?
So I'm going to reject your concept on its face. Mostly because, my answer would be no. But I don't think it's because I think it's a bad idea. It's because I don't think that we would be at a situation where you as an adult are modifying unless you are an extreme case. That this would have to be a way of life that is so ingrained that you would be looking at it as a service to your child that you would want to screen them or genetically edit them for a better life. It would have to be, you had to watch polio kill a bunch of kids before it became a thing that every kid gets vaccinated for polio, right?
And I guess an alternate scenario might be literally the moon's going to fall into the ocean. And so we only have so much time to get creative if we want off.
Say that again?
If the moon was going to fall into the ocean or some unstoppable asteroid or something was going to destroy...
And we had to leave in spaceships that have been hidden.
No. Like, let's say we have, you know, X number 100 years, but there's one thing, like, ain't no Armageddon scenario, ain't no Deep Impact, ain't no heroic fire a rocket blast away. Let's say it's a cloud of moons, sir, and they're going to be here at so and so time. We can immediately populate the stars because, you know, over the next 200 years, if we do nothing but build Elon Musk's starships and get out there, we could do it.
You are setting up a scenario where we would have to eject into space immediately.
Relatively immediately. I mean, yes. Enough. Let's give us a few generations, right?
But even then, I still think that you wouldn't see broad genetic editing or anything like that. I'd
hate to admit it, but I think you're right because people still have. Are you familiar with golden rice?
Yes.
There are still countries that make it illegal to accept golden rice because it's genetically modified. Golden rice is rich in vitamin A, saving the eyesight of children and the lives of children who primarily are raised on rice.
I think obviously you get into some of the cultural elements of it, but you also, whenever you're talking about affecting children in general, or parents' decisions about their kids, you're always going to naturally move in the most conservative direction. Like that, I think, is hard-coded into us as primates, is first, keep them alive. How do I keep them alive? I follow the guidance of everybody that was before me, and I gather as much information about common wisdom, right? Like, and this, we're being bombarded with a lot of evidence through media and friends now, my wife and I, as we are about to welcome our first daughter. But
what?
In general, it's not a lot of wacky stuff, right? It's not a lot of like, hey, always keep them in half a bowl of water. Like, there's some of that. There's some elements. But in general, what you are looking at, the advice that cuts through are either time-tested things of here's what generations of people have done, or a people are bending over backwards to talk about the scientific reason why X, Y, or Z. But even then, we're talking about things like windows in which you feed them and then put them to sleep, right? Like things that were going to happen anyway, but here's the specific Konami code to make them sleep through the night, stuff like that. It's not anything radical. So I think inherently you would have to see the problem. A generation would have to see a problem before they did anything. So in your example, let's say it's a cloud of moons that is going to hit Earth. We now have 200 years to figure out where we're going to hide for the great mooning.
Right.
There would have to be a generation of people that left and then died at a specific rate before you would see any kind of initiative from people on Earth to say, okay, if I'm having a kid now, they're going to be on a ship in 18 years. I want to make sure that they don't die like at the rate that these people did. And I think you're going to see every element of trying to stop that without any kind of medical intervention and only saving for that not working. So two generations, would you see people saying, oh, okay, well, maybe if there was some sort of genetic screening or some sort of genetic editing, then this will be less than. But a lot of people would have to die before humans took a preventative measure to make somebody live.
Yeah, I think you're right as far as hardened cultural attitudes go. I wonder if 200 years would be enough. That would be enough for you to see, let's say, two generations of best and brightest 18-year-olds, like, let's say we're able to get to space and we're able to hollow out asteroids and we're able to build these moon bases, but the unpleasantness of zero G and cosmic rays, where it's like people who were there at the beginning of the program are still hale and hearty at 72 years old on Earth. And they're all like, I've seen three generations of children go up and they've all died horrifically due to these disease.
Yeah.
I could picture at that point saying it's time for us to look into tinkering with our code a bit if we intend to survive this.
But that's if, yeah. I just think even in the realm of solutions, I think at the first person who dies, somebody there will be top men endeavoring to make the next person not die.
Just like there are already top men writing theses defending having sex with robots. Like there isn't even a problem yet, but they're already writing these like finally, yes.
Well, that particular issue, I think you found a lot of volunteers in that army. You didn't really need to conscript them. That's been on the wish list for a certain element of humanity for a minute now.
Oh, come on, a bunch of moons and somehow make it so that only there's one way to survive.
Wow, what a weird new remake of The Last Starfighter, huh?
I wonder how you win the Excalibur Protocol in that movie.
If it were a different show, the last word wouldn't be fighter.
Patreon.com/weirdthings is where you can keep us rocking here at weirdthings.com. Patreon.com/weirdthings. You get early access to After Things. Just to prove that we're serious about it, we're not going to do it this week.
Yeah, unfortunately, a few things have conspired against us. Number one, the great Andrew Main is at a conference, and Brian has been waylaid by a long recovery from the COVID.
Yeah, dude. I ain't going to go so far as to say I'm one of those long haulers, but weirdly, I think I just got lucky the first two times and had fairly short bouts, but even though, you know, I'm not infectious, I don't show antigens, I don't have a fever, I just a little bit of coughs and sniffles, but my goodness, I don't usually sleep 16 hours a day, but I have been. It's been really
weird. You have about an hour of stage performance.
Yes.
In, yeah.
And then it's like, and then like, and then I'm just like, show me down.
Yeah. I mean, we did Great Night on Tuesday, and at the end of the night, I was like, is everything okay? And you're like, yeah. everything's fine.
It's okay.
Everything's great right now.
I beat COVID.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's good.
Anyway.
Patreon.com/weirdthings. Keep us supported. Keep us in business.
Heck yeah, dude. What? Oh, can I tell you something? A fun Austin moment that I had only in Austin, this city, on Wednesday. I go to get my teeth cleaned.
Yeah.
Turns out my dental hygienist, who has cleaned my teeth for the last several years, is in Robert Rodriguez's band.
No way!
Yeah. And he was talking to me about stuff, and we wound up getting on the subject of AI. Robert Rodriguez, according to my dental hygienist, who plays in his band,
or sources,
is obsessed with Udio.
Oh, really?
And keeps sending him Udio songs. to which my dental hygienist, I did not get to have much of a conversation with him since he had sharp objects pointed into my mouth as he scraped my teeth. So he just kind of went on a monologue about how he doesn't like AI or AI music. But he was getting a little annoyed with his friend, famous director and writer Robert Rodriguez, because he kept sending him Udio songs, and he was like, "Man, this one's great." He's like, "This is gonna save me so much money." To which my dental hygienist reminded him, "Robert, your son's a composer."
Okay, so I mean, our official response as a program has, mm-hmm, I believe, always been, that's why his son should learn the tools now so he can direct an orchestra.
So I don't know. I mean, I think it follows along with the idea that a lot of like really big creatives have seized on AI for a lot of different practical reasons. There's a lot of different things that are kind of happening right now. And if you look at the development of it, how fast it's coming along, I mean, good Lord, even AI music, you know, there was a Wolfram Alpha but it was the same people that did it. Had a computer generated music platform like years ago, like 10 years ago.
Yeah, I think I think they even made a musical version of the game of life, you know, that the game where it's like you start with a seed of like three dots and then, mm-hmm, the rules are they duplicate in weird ways and it's like, whoa, man, you're listening to life.
Yeah. Now that obviously was not large language model technology, but to the end retail user, it was the same thing. I want a certain kind of song. Oh my God, no human touches it. Now all of a sudden I've got a certain kind of song. Now, between Suno initially and then Udio, which to me holds the heavyweight championship when it comes to AI music, especially with their vocals, because the Udio vocals are
clearer,
pretty good,
and whereas Suno sounds a little bit soupy, like a bit too much reverb on everything.
But that has been amazing, and it only continues to get better. The big question is, and this is something that's happened since the last time that we talked about AI music, is that both Suno and Udio have been hit with the lawsuit I'm sure they were waiting for, you know, however many months they've been operating. Every major record label has sued them saying there's no way that you could be doing this without using our copyrighted work to train your model. And, you know, we're going to find out this year and next year, I believe, a lot of the resolutions of these cases. And I don't know whether or not we're going to get actual judges' decisions. It looks like the AI companies want that because they think that they are in the right when it comes to this, or if the powers that be are just going to push for a licensing deal to say, okay, well, you just pay us money and now you'll have the right to train things on this.
In an official statement, the Beastie Boys were said to have said, "Whew, barely made it." Right before anyone knew it was a problem, the Beastie Boys famously liberally sampled an awful lot and were did so before the great controversy of the early 90s about how much sampling is sampling until you're just playing Prince's When Doves Cry and rapping over it.
Yeah, but I don't know if that's going to be the same thing that this is guided on, because you don't hear anything involving the songs that this model is trained on based on what you have, some elements of it, but would it be any different if you use just the best version of the Wolfram Alpha technology? Like, obviously the answer is yes, because that technology cannot produce this result, but you know, the reality of the models are that you're going to rely less and less on this kind of stuff. As soon as the model can detect the secret sauce that makes pop music, that makes opera music, that makes a score, it's going to be able to use it to create these new treasures.
Well, and that is one of the interesting things. You can industrialize feeding a large language model to a degree that it's difficult to do with a human, but ultimately, what is a human composer but somebody who you train on certain models and have them listen to why this is good, that's good, and the whole thing, and then write their version of it. Even we talked a few years ago about temp tracks, and as iconic as the Star Wars theme is, when you hear the temp track that was used up until, you know, John Williams was like, "Oh yeah, no, I get what they're doing." It's if you heard them in reverse order, you would swear that one is a pale direct knockoff rip.
Yeah.
Of the other. Yeah. Same thing with like I don't know. There's a bunch of music from Christopher Nolan films and. It's if temp tracks are fair game and then somebody just comes in and, you know, just switches up the melody a bit, keeps those big hits, changes this brass to that brass.
If I can go back to my dental hygienist, he did have a few things that he complimented AI music for. The first was exactly that, inspiration. So essentially being able to use AI as a temp track that then gives you an idea that then you take in whatever direction you're going to take it. And he apparently does a lot of work for commercial and television music. So being able to put things in a library that commercials and television and movies will then take from to make whatever they're doing. And sometimes you can kind of skip the line of the library and just go right into a show. One of the shows that he is apparently working on something for, or he got a request for, I won't name it, but let's say that it's a show about a post-apocalyptic future that has a very heavy influence of 1950s culture.
Okay.
So he was saying, all right, I have a song that's very much in the style of the 60s that he's like, I could actually use this to pitch to this show. Then he's like, well, but what do they think of as the 50s? Because the 50s had a lot of different music, and you can't just take some obscure song that you like, you know, the Roy Donks of the world from the Colgate Hour and decide that that is everything from the 50s. So he went on Udio and apparently asked Robert Rodriguez and said, hey, what's that website? And
then what's that website I hate so much?
And then Robert Rodriguez like, go, you were probably making fun of me yesterday, bro. But he wanted to do it so he could create a 50s song so he could hear what the AI thinks of when somebody asks for a 50s song. What are the hallmarks that you would immediately recognize as that? because he wants to use the vocals and the timing of this this more 1960s song. So I thought that was an interesting story.
And of course, AI is, as we've talked about before, is essentially just a mirror of whatever it's trained on. It's a mirror of what came before. So when you're asking an AI what it thinks, you're really asking what is, give or take, the sum total of humanity think a 1950s song sounds like.
Yeah.
I hadn't noticed this one. I was thinking of the fanfare for the Luke Skywalker theme, but this is the temp track. Do you know what the temp track is for, this is a comparison here. This is the opening shot. So there's the Tantive IV being, you know, shot at by the large Star Destroyer.
I can't see anything if you're trying to show me something.
I'm deliberately not trying to show it. Gotcha. Okay. so that I don't have to take it down.
Gotcha.
But then I assume it's only a minute long clip here, so I assume it's about to play the original now. Okay, there we go. So, and then this is the planets. Temp track. The temp track was Mars, the Bringer of War by Holst, and they're showing the same footage. And that even that end part is very much reminiscent of that moment that they blow up the Death Star.
Yeah.
So anyway, temp tracks, they're a real thing. It's hard for me to distinguish the ethics of going from temp tracks to LLMs.
Yeah. The question that then becomes is what is legal, right? Because at the end of the day, everybody's going to want to get paid. But you're more on the ethics thing, because that's probably the conversation that you're more enmeshed in with your artistic family that has controversially explicit opinions about AI.
Well, and here's one thing I know as a dad is the fastest way to convince your kids of the opposite of what you want to convince them to is to argue with them. So I've kept my mouth fairly shut and just shrugged and say like, well, seems like it's happening. but I do wish that for any artist, when you're getting started or you feel like you barely have caught the end of a shooting star, it's easy to feel like those flashes of inspiration are fleeting and rare, and the idea that they could be roboticized is pretty terrifying. And I'm sure that's how it was for assembly line workers on, Ford's assembly lines and for the weavers in India who felt like, no machine can perfectly craft what they do with the loom and all of that. So it's like my impulse is to be very, very kind and thoughtful, but I wish I knew, nothing, but to be honest, it kind of goes back to that genetic engineering thing. It's good. Nothing but actually seeing the results is going to convince people of otherwise. Like before you consider genetically modifying human gene stock, you're going to have to watch three generations go up and then melt in 20 years in space before you think, okay, maybe we should consider this.
Yeah, I do think that AI is going to be a little bit different in terms of mass adoption against criticism, because we've yet to see it really even be on mass scale, fully deployed into the things that we use all the time. We're mm-hmm. only just now beginning to just see a lot of manual things that are dumb, that are time consuming. Now they're going to be totally wrapped up in AI. Menial tasks are going to be a lot easier because of things that are not controversial, but they're just faster to do. With
like,
AI.
Like doing the laundry, when that Tesla bot is able to be all like, yeah, I got it.
Well, I'm thinking of more web things now, but sure. Yeah. Down the road. Absolutely. I'm thinking of things like, your books, taxes, your, keeping track of all of your, your subscriptions, just having more, like I've talked about this a lot. We've done nothing, but with our smart devices, our watches and our phones, kept meticulous recordings of everything, our biometrics, our text messages, our emails, and it's a lot, our photos, it's a lot of data. For what? Like, what do we actually get out of it? Aside from just very, very, very rudimentary counting stats on certain things. You burned this amount of calories yesterday and this amount of calories a week from now. Like, that doesn't really give you a projection, doesn't tell you anything more about your life. It doesn't tell you anything better. We are at a point now where a lot of that is just going to magically get better. And people aren't going to really know why. They'll just know, oh, it does an AI thing. It's just going to be a rising tide. Right now, what freaks people out are the all-in-one magic boxes. And many of those are useful. It's been AI music has been useful to us as we have worked on episodes of World's Greatest Con, where before I was looking through moods in public directories or, you know, that you had to pay for, but they are publicly available directories for music, which is why sometimes you'll hear podcast theme songs or songs that you've heard from somewhere else in commercials because everybody's fishing from the same pond to AI music. Now, all of a sudden, if I need a song, a brooding cinematic score that, is mysterious but has naval elements to it.
Right.
I get that immediately and I can go through five different versions of it until I get the closest to what I want.
And on the top of that, you could say layer some sci-fi elements, not even knowing what you mean by sci-fi elements, yeah. But instead you get like some flange and a little bit of harsh, you know, synth edges to it. And you're like, yeah, that's what I want. That yeah. kind of thing.
But, you know, other than that, if you're not in a professional capacity to use this kind of stuff, then it does just seem scary. It does just give you an existential worry of, well, why am I learning guitar? Or why am I learning to draw? Why am I learning X, Y, and Z when it's going to be easy? I'm very much with Andrew's perspective on this, who has been far more in the belly of the beast of a lot of the bleeding edge of this technology, that you're always going to want to know what you want out of this thing by learning those tools, because you're going to be so much better at getting exactly what you want. And when the bar for all this stuff starts going up, the music starts getting better, starts sounding more professional, the graphics all are clean, like when all that happens, that little bit is going to be the difference between what everybody does and what you can do. So I still think that a lot of those talents are really, really important. It's just not the same thing as, okay, well, I'm going to learn guitar so I can record my guitar into it. I still think that that's going to be a really, really valuable tool. It'll just be different. It'll have more utility.
Yeah, I think there's kind of two levels. Number one, think about, you know, as we've talked about before, I am of the belief that we're all directors now. You know, we're all in charge. We're all managers in charge of writers' rooms and so on, and which means our jobs, which are the same jobs we've always had in the arts, are number one, know what's wrong with something. Know the difference between good and bad and be able to point to what's bad about it. And then number two, have the words, and that's the new part, is just have the words to explain why it's wrong.
Yeah.
You know, in the case of Whiplash, it's quite simply not my tempo. Like that was, you know, whatever you perceive that movie to be about, when J.K. Simmons says not my tempo, you knew that the problem was the tempo.
Yeah.
that the guy was not doing right. And now personally, I can't wait to throw a cymbal at the head of an AI. But maybe it'll cause all of us to become raving megalomaniacs.
Well, some of us are already there.
Hey, man, you got any picks?
Yeah, picks.
I can go first if you want.
Yeah, well, I'll just do House of the Dragon. It's okay. Hey, these dragons, they did a big dragon fight. If boy, you ever wanted to see dragons fighting. Dragon fighting is weird because it's so much better in your head than it is in reality. And this is the problem with House of the Dragon, for whatever the rest of the plot issues, is that dragons are awesome, right?
Sure.
People riding dragons.
It's sort of like
kind of silly.
There's one element that, like, do we really need that part?
Just like,
hey, maybe go left. Thanks, boss. I never thought about that. Yeah. I'm only a dragon who flies. What would I know about it?
Yeah. You know, House of the Dragon.
Yeah.
Where else are you going to keep dragons?
In a house.
In a house. In a house.
There was a fantasy / science fiction book series called the Adept series from Pierce Anthony. And it was like two worlds. One was a fantasy world. One was a sci-fi world. And they were separated by a curtain. And if you were cool, you could go and, you know, inhabit the body of your match on the other side.
Mm.
But like, it turns out the O. Henry short story, both sides wanted what the other one had. So the science fiction side, they would take like brains of dogs and put them in cybernetic bodies. So they were like, hey man, we got dragons. We got dragons too over here. My pick is Fargo season 5.
If you Fargo, you will go far.
This was maybe so far, I think I'm on episode 6 of 8. Maybe the most over the top cartoonish of them so far. It's in that there's a very, very good person who's very, very good and awesome at everything always. And there's a very, very bad person who's very, very bad.
Yeah.
And then they go out of their way to make it clear how bad, bad, bad they are. But there are a couple of interesting mushy middle characters, but it's when I say it's the most cartoonish Fargo yet, I mean that as a high, high compliment. It brought me vibes of Legion almost in the over the topness of how awesome everyone is.
Yeah, you know, and I would totally agree with that. It is more of a morality play, and as you matriculate your way through the series, I think that you have identified a theme that will reward you. Fargo as a series tends to recycle a lot of characters from not only the Fargo movies, but the kind of wider Coen Brothers universe. Like, you will see a lot of archetypes that have been in other Coen Brothers movies, things. This one has a few of them. It's got the overly competent sidekick, the domineering boss, the nearly impossible henchman who is, you know, got his own weird world about him. But you're right, our two poles are our hero and our villain. There is no question who has the halo and who has the horns. And as you move along, I think you will very much enjoy that it gets to do some pretty like brutal medieval storytelling, because it's not here to tell you maybe the good guy's bad or maybe the bad guy's good.
I would be very surprised if that's where it suddenly went.
Yeah. I mean, obviously you have moments of weakness or moments of manipulation that shade around the white and black kind of hues of either of these characters, but there's no question there is a very, very, very bad person. There is a very, very, very good person, and you're going to see the good person tested, and you're going to see the bad person try to prosecute the villainous plan. So I'm so excited for you to get to the end of it. You're next to it. You're close to it, I believe. Have you gotten to the episode where she meets the
mother?
Yeah.
She meets the mother, and the mother offers her a gig. And
no.
Okay.
It's, no.
That's
no,
the
no.
one I just finished.
Okay. You haven't. All right. I won't spoil anything. Yeah. Noah Hawley is a very, very big talent. He did a version of an episode that I hate. It's usually a hallmark that this is a trash show, and the man pulled it off.
All right. And it's in this series.
Oh yeah, Jerry.
Okay. All right. Oh, yeah. All right.
Oh yeah.
I'm totally here for it.
Yeah.
Man. Well, I guess those are our picks. We'll hear back from one Andrew Main next week. Sorry.
Oh that yeah.
We're keeping it short this week, but doggone it. Thank you to our patrons over at patreon.com/weirdthings. We're keeping it real and keeping it relatively on time.
Yep.
Thank you, everyone. It's been weird.